Good evening and welcome to the latest episode of Talking the Blues. As ever, I have Andy Costigan with me. Good evening, Andy.
Evening, Paul.
And I have George, who's still up in Scotland. Good evening, George.
Yeah, in the Cairngorms. Fantastic. Wow.
Wonderful yes. stuff.
Beautiful.
Well, we're three happy bunnies this evening. I think.
I'll qualify that.
We might be perceived as being fickle bunnies, seeing as last 2 weeks ago we were ready to hang, draw and quarter Marco Silva.
My jury's still out on all that.
Yeah.
Well, come on, Andy. If you have to have four losses before you play properly, where's that going to leave us at the end of the season?
No. I don't get me wrong. I've not turned turtle. I just it was quite staggering, the difference on Saturday against West Ham to those previous four outings, particularly the Bournemouth, Villa and Sheffield United games, when quite honestly Everton didn't turn up, because they sure as heck turned up on Saturday against West Ham.
Why?
I don't know, bro.
I'm glad they did, but
I think 39,000 others were immensely glad as well. But I think the fact that we didn't have two defensive midfielders, that he put Gomez and Davies together, both of whom were very willing to get forward and move the ball forward quickly.
Yeah,
I think that made everyone think, oh, this is going to be different. And then, I mean, I called it a floating front four with Iwobi, Bernard, Richarlison and Walcott, with one of them kind of rotating all the time to drop back a little bit to take the ball from or to be the outlet for Davies and Gomez as they push forward. And it was noticeable that they did rotate, and they all rotated through the positions in the front line as well. West Ham, in all honesty, whilst they weren't very good themselves, they probably didn't know whether they needed to go to the toilet or have an haircut, because Everton were buzzing round like proverbial bees. And even in the pre-game warm-up, there was a distinct difference in body language. I actually text a friend to say, I know it's only warm-up and we shouldn't get carried away, but the body language looks massively different. I mean, When Lursel was in goal warming up, Iwobi put three super volleys past him. One from outside the box, one from just inside the box, and then a neat side foot volley from across from Dina from the left-hand side that was just sublime. And I thought, hang on, they're up for it, these guys. They just looked ready to go. And they set off like a house on fire, and brilliantly, they never let the pace drop through the game. It was excellent to see. It really was. I mean, so much, light years difference to those games against Sheffield United and Villa and Bournemouth. Just immense difference.
Andy.
Oh.
Yes, Paul.
If we can, sorry, George. Could
no, no, go ahead. I was only going to nitpick.
If we can start from the beginning.
Yeah.
what was I think. I want to ask you a question, then I want to make a comment.
Okay.
What was the atmosphere inside the ground before the game?
Fine. I didn't get the feeling that there was any rumblings at all. There didn't appear to be any. I certainly didn't notice any negativity from the crowd prior to the teams emerging from the locker room. They came out. There was the usual, you know, deafening noise, and everyone seemed up for it. And the team were up for it, and they went for it right from the off.
This is what happens when you drop Schneiderlin. People cheer up.
Well, I mean, without jumping on the Schneiderlin pillory trail, yes. There was the only defensive side of the game at the weekend, if you like, was Keane and Mina. Because Sidibe and Dina both wanted to get forward. And I think that with Sidibe being there, and nothing against Seamus Coleman, you can't have anything against Seamus. You know, £60,000 all those years ago, and we've had great service out of him. But Sidibe gave us a little bit extra than Seamus has given us in recent weeks. He looked quicker. He looked a bit more adventurous. And I think he gave Walcott the freedom to go and play as we know Theo Walcott used to play when he was a gooner, with Gay Abandon up front. There didn't appear to be any, I'll say, need for Walcott to be covering Sidibe in the way that we've expected him to be prepared to cover for dear old Seamus. And Walcott was a revelation on Saturday.
Good.
Right. The second part of my question was.
Go on, give us the third part first.
More a statement.
Jimmy Greaves.
More a statement than a question, because I think, George, this brings you into the conversation. I picked up on a quote by Iwobi. I'll talk a bit more about him later, because I thought he was excellent on Saturday. But he said that Marco Silva told the players before the game, and his exact quote was, "Express yourself and be free."
Well, that's exactly what, you know, good coaches should say to players. What's he been saying for the rest of the time? got said at Burnley?
Yeah,
that was my immediate thought. There was a thought, wasn't there? Although it didn't look like they've been coached in previous games, because it looked like they didn't know each other, there has been a line of thought that says actually the players have been overcoached, and they've, you know, the system is, as we talked about on previous podcasts, has been extremely rigid.
Yeah.
And, you know, we funnel the ball out wide wherever possible, square across the back, and then try and, you know, attack teams down the wings, get the ball into the middle. And of course, there's nobody in the middle because, you know, we're only playing one up front. And it's been a regular pattern week in, week out. And I just wondered if, you know, Iwobi making that comment, actually, there's the key to the difference in performances, that the players were allowed to express themselves, and they were allowed to be freer. As you said, Andy, you know, the front four were all over the place and constantly, you know, switching positions, sometimes going inside, sometimes going outside, sometimes appearing on the left wing, sometimes appearing on the right wing. And
exactly, the freedom was totally different. That movement, the fluid movement of the front four, absolutely bamboozled West Ham. Honestly, for half an hour, they really didn't know what on earth they were playing against. They just couldn't keep up.
So we have to assume that Marco has listened to our podcast and all the criticism and gone, right, okay, I won't play 4-2-3-1. And the players have all gone, thank God for that.
I think he did play 4-2-3-1. It's just that the three and the one were never rigid in the way that when DCL was playing, and again, no disrespect to DCL, but when he was the one, that was it. He was the one. But on Saturday, 1 minute, Richarlison was up front, then it was Bernard, then Walcott was up there, and then Iwobi was coming into the mix as well.
No,
we had four number ones, if you like, and then we had any permutation of the other three as the three. It was 4-2-3-1, but it was so fluid. It was almost ridiculous. You never quite knew who was going to turn up where.
It's quite interesting. On the sorry, George, again. On the Everton website, I only realised today when I was doing some research before the podcast, they have like a little chart that shows, or a little graphic rather, that shows the average positions of everybody on the pitch.
Right.
And we actually, from the average positions, we actually played two at the back, which obviously the two central defenders, a very flat midfield of four, and then a two and a two. So we had interestingly, Richarlison up front but Awoa will be very, very close to him, just behind him. And also Walcott quite close to him as well on the right-hand side. And we also obviously then we had Bernard just sitting behind them, but over on the left-hand side. And the thing that struck me was something that we talked about in the last podcast, was that all over the pitch, there were little partnerships forming all over the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the two central defenders, actually, I mean, West Ham didn't really cause many threats, but I thought the two central defenders, and Mina in particular, played really, really well. And the bit that I really enjoyed about watching them on Saturday was that when they got the ball, they distributed the ball very, very quickly. There wasn't this sort of, you know, sitting on the ball, pushing the ball for, you know, 10, 15 yards forward to the central midfield defensive unit that we've adopted in the past. They actually looked to get the ball forward, either to Bernard or to Awobi, as quickly as they possibly could. And if they didn't get the ball, then obviously having Gomez and having Davis in the side made the movement of the ball forward much quicker as well. And I thought that was quite striking. The little partnerships all over. Andy, you were there, so maybe you saw it. But it seemed to me like there were little partnerships all over the pitch.
There was. I mean, I think we said, you know, a couple of weeks ago that Deeney and Bernard last year were striking up a Baines-Pienaar-esque partnership on the left-hand side. And obviously, that seemed to work really well again on Saturday. But also, like I said, with Sidibe and Walcott, you know, seemed to gel right off the bat. And Davis and Gomez complemented each other tremendously well in midfield. I thought, if you were marking the whole side out of 10, without getting carried away, nobody, absolutely nobody, got less than an 8. Seriously. Yeah. I mean, you know, Michael Keane, God bless him, you know, he's taken some horrific stick, not only from Evertonians, but from the media for his performances for England. But he looked very solid on Saturday. You know, Mina catches the eye much more than Michael Keane does. And Mina did have a good game. There's no doubt about it.
While you're on that subject, because I'm ready, you know, not my laptop's down, so I've got no Everton gossip. What is the word on Mina's hamstring?
Well, they're saying it's a knee problem. And funnily enough, I kind of had a little email discussion with someone today while I was on a train, because he definitely went down in our area and got up holding his right hamstring. Right. But then when he came up, I didn't notice it as he limped off the field because I was making notes for my match report. But the guy I was emailing with today said that he came off holding his knee. So, and apparently the club have reported that it's a right knee issue, and you know, hopefully he'll come through it for next weekend.
Right.
One of the really interesting things about Mina was, he looks as if he's absolutely really, or he looked on Saturday, excuse me, as if he's absolutely really enjoying his football.
Mina?
Yeah.
He's playing well, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean,
I think they all look to be enjoying it, in fairness, Paul, not just Yerry Mina. I mean, every single one of them was playing, you know, at pace and with intensity and with a smile on the face. It really was great to see. It's been long overdue, that has to be said, and it goes back to the questions of why has it taken 9 games for us to finally play the way we expect to see an Everton team play, you know, full of commitment and passion and everything else. But
we haven't really played like that, unless my memory is, you know, has gone completely. Mm-hmm. We haven't really played like that in the whole time that Silva's been in charge of the team. Yes, we had some decent performances towards the back end of the season, mm-hmm. but the rapid movement of the ball, you know, through the lines, which we did time and time again. I can't recall seeing much of that from Everton. It's obviously not this season, other than Saturday, but I can't recall seeing much of that last season either.
So are we in a situation where we hope something similar will happen at Brighton? Well, obviously we are, because what we want to happen. But
we have to hope, though. But you know, he surely wouldn't be cautious. I was going to say crazy enough, but I'll say cautious in his approach at Brighton, and go back to his rigid 4-2-3-1 with the two being two defensive midfielders. We've shown what we can do against a side that was in form. I mean, that's West Ham's first defeat on the road this season.
Right.
Why would you go? I mean, all right, Brighton are playing well, but why after demolishing West Ham? And it was a demolition, because we hit the woodwork twice and had two efforts disallowed, and the goal he made. The goalie made a good stop from Davis early on when Davis really should have scored. I think he was probably a bit taken by surprise when the ball came to him, but the goalie did make a good save. And he made a couple of other decent saves as well, a keeper. If Saturday had been 4 or maybe 5-0, West Ham couldn't have complained. They genuinely could not have complained if they'd been spanked. Because they were spanked, it just wasn't reflected in the scoreline.
Right.
So why would you go to Brighton and revert back to a system that's patently doesn't
some
work?
Some of us have been asking that for 8 games, you know, and I'm happy if the man has found the formula. And I'm sure, you know, football's such a fluid thing, and the broken leg and, you know, red card here and there, and everything's tipped upside down. And, you know, and I can see why sometimes you go, oh, let's get a bloody point, and you know, but because we're not going to win the league, you kind of even more so want the team to go out and just play. And what sounds so infuriating about reading the reports on the match on Saturday was that that's what they did. And you know, having not watched it because I was doing a show and all that, you just kind of go, why has it taken 4 defeats in a row for this to happen? And what's going to happen next? Well, it's pointless asking what's going to happen next, because we'll find out on Saturday. But it's just hugely frustrating.
Can I ask another pointless question? Because I often ask pointless questions, or questions that are difficult to answer accurately. If you wanted to be rather unkind to Silva, you could say that the team selection was forced upon him. And you know, maybe this was just come about by chance rather than by design, because you know, I suspect had Coleman been available, the link up with Walcott wouldn't have been as good as it was with Sidibe. I think if Delph had played, probably Tom Davis wouldn't have played, and you know, the central midfield too would have been much more static than they actually were. So I wonder if this is a sort of a case of by accident and sort of, because he really didn't have many more choices, did he? I mean, you know, that was as good a team as he could put out. That it changed.
History is full of those things, isn't it?
Yep.
We all remember Inchy saving Howie's career, and Ferguson was going to get the sack, but they sneaked a win against somebody. And even in the World Cup, when we won the World Cup, and Jimmy Greaves got injured, and Roger Umpton, and you know, those things happen. And I wouldn't want to deny the man the luck of serendipity. And presumably, he is 100% happier than he was after last week's mess against Burnley.
Sure. So, he made a couple of aggressive calls, didn't he? Because, I mean, he obviously Sigurdsson was fit, because Sigurdsson was on the bench and eventually came on.
Yeah.
That was, you know, I suppose that was an assertive call, wasn't it? Not to play Sigurdsson.
Yeah. Yeah, and picking Davis.
Yeah.
You know, and the guy's been sat on the bench, and now he gives him a whole game, and everything changes. I don't know. God, it's so complicated, isn't it? All those personalities, and you know, you and I, we can never know what the chemistry is in the dressing room.
No, I don't. You can't. But I noted when they interviewed Theo Walcott for Match of the Day, and he was talking, you know, that, you know, the squad is together, but, you know, what goes on in the dressing room or in the locker room or in the training ground stays there.
Yeah.
And he had a rather steely-eyed look about him, did Theo Walcott. And just like a solid pro, you know, he wasn't talking nonsense. He was talking very lucidly and sensibly, and, you know, we know what we're doing. Without saying it in so many words, we know what we've done wrong, but we are working hard and we are together. We're all on the same page. And it just, you know, it made me think back to, you know, when Luckman was here and people saying, why are we keep playing Walcott? Why doesn't he give Luckman a chance? And I'd been to Finch Farm a couple of times to watch a couple of training sessions, and Walcott works probably one of the hardest workers in training of the outfield players. And you think back and you think that's why he got selected, because he impresses in training. And he just came across in his Match of the Day interview as being a really good, solid pro. And he gave probably his best performance in a blue shirt on Saturday.
Well, you know, in terms of all that, there's nothing, you know, nothing we can do but sit and hope and hope it's the beginning of not a run, you know, that stuff at the end of last season, which was great, you know, was always described as a really good run. It's not a run we need. It's a solid attitude that these are the levels you may not drop off.
Yes.
Nothing, anything less than what happened on Saturday is unacceptable. That's the bit that I doubt about Marco Silva, and I would love to be proved wrong, and I'll be the first person to give him a golden slipper.
No, but you're right, Arkin. They set a benchmark on Saturday.
I hope so, Andy, because yeah. There's no evidence that Everton squad is, what's the word, stable, or, you know, is what's the word, consistent.
Mm.
And it will be nice to think that at least the levels of commitment are consistent.
Yeah.
And the levels of enjoyment. You know, you were there. You said, you know, I remember you texting me to say they looked up for it before they kicked the ball.
Yeah. They genuinely did. Seriously.
That's not too much to ask, you know. I'm in the same job, really. I'm going out to entertain the public. Tomorrow night, no, not tomorrow night, Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And I'm fully expected to do my best.
Mm.
And I fully expect to do my best. And that doesn't seem like too much to ask. You can't manufacture inspiration. But you can go, it won't go below this.
Yeah.
For want of trying.
No, I agree. Agreed, Arkid. I mean, the work ethic and the commitment on Saturday was head and shoulders above anything we've seen this season. Head and shoulders.
I would say that A, fills me with delight, and B, fills me with horror. And I would be very happy if we stopped having that conversation,
yeah.
because we got beat, but the commitment levels and the effort was absolutely spot on. You can't fault it. You know, we will get beat. There are teams better than us in this league.
Yeah.
That's fun. You know, I don't mind that. What I can't bear is
capitulation.
Well, you just, you know, yeah, yeah, heads down. You know.
Yeah.
George, that's interesting because you are a performer, you know, as a profession. It's been your profession all of your life. Of course, there may be times when you act better than you do on other occasions. That's just the nature of being a human being. But I suspect that there haven't been many occasions in your career where you haven't wanted to go out and do the best that you possibly could do beforehand.
But, of course not, but there are times when you're in a turkey and you just go, just keep your dignity, play your corner, that's all you can do, do your best, that's all you can do. It's never, you're never going to, you know, there's a very rude expression in the theatre, which I won't repeat here, about what you can and can't polish.
I think we could probably perm that. And
it's after the watershed, George, you find.
All right, yeah. But, you know, I understand, you know, the kind of, the, you know, temperament. And for goodness sake, and this must make a difference. I've been doing this now for 40-odd years, and I'm going to go out, and maybe there'll be 200 people there on Wednesday afternoon. That'd be great. These are young men going out, and there's 35, 40,000 people. And from, you know, the incidents that happened at Yeovil and Haring, at the Yeovil-Haring game match, they have to listen to moronic crap all the time and not be put off and not, you know, I don't have people barracking me while I'm working. Well, not very often. But you know what I mean? I mean, I wouldn't, yeah, like, the stress levels and they're extraordinary and hard to replicate, I would have thought.
When you're performing in a play, you're obviously performing usually with a group of a number of other people, however big the cast may be. Do you not get the situation and I'm just interested in this because one's related to football. Do you not get the situation where if you see one of the cast not having a great day, other people like pick up the slack?
Yeah, you do, and you know, and you're definitely onto the minutes interval, going, what's going on? You know, when you got a chance to go, come on, just keep it simple, don't complicate things. You know, I guess football players must do just track the ball and pass it. Just, you know, get a couple of decent touches in. Don't try and, you know, go past everybody all in one go. Yeah, and you know, it is a team thing. You know, in the end, what you realise, and this must be the same football player, they're going to play 38 games in that league. One of those games, whether we like it or not, will be the best. They're going to wallop somebody, you know, and one of them will be the worst, where they get completely trolled. The job, you know, we're going to do 29 shows of this show. One will be the best, one will be the worst, but the job is to make the gap between the best and the worst as small as possible. Mm. That's the gig, and that, you know, that's what at the moment Liverpool are doing so brilliantly.
No, let's not bring them into it.
Well, they didn't do it so brilliantly against your arch rivals, Manchester United, did they?
So. For once, we were behind the red half of Manchester.
I think in line with some of the comments that we've had about the podcast. Just going slightly sort of off field for a second. A couple of people have asked me, why are two lads from Salford Evertonians?
Here we go. Go for it, bro.
Well, I was a Bolton Wanderers supporter, and then they got relegated. And I just stood there and, you know, they were poor, that team. And I just stood there and thought, I'm not watching second division football. And if you got to the age of 15, which is what I was, 16, in living in Manchester, and you've not been a Manchester United supporter or City supporter, you can't become one. It's absolutely not going to happen, because by then you hate them with a passion you reserve for nothing else, because everything's about them. The papers, you know, the back page of all the papers is an extension of the United programme, and it just drives you mad. And Everton had just won the league, and, you know, me and Andy grew up on our little house was near the East Lancs Road, so I just hitchhiked down the road to watch the Champions of England, Everton, and I fell in love with not only Everton and the colour and Royston Vernon and Alec Young and all that lot, but the city. I've never been to a place like Liverpool. Salford is not Liverpool by no means, and all the poorer for it. And I just, suddenly there was an excuse to go and have the crack with all these people. I was only thinking today about the guys that I got to know in the Gladys Street when I was 16, 17, and I used to meet them every week and And they taught me all the things I was supposed to hate, like we hate Bill Shankly and we hate Big Ron and we hate St. John and all, you know. And I knew who these people were, but I learned the tunes and everything. And I was just thinking today about the first time I went to watch a European match. We were playing Ujpest Doza on a Tuesday night at Goodison, and out comes Ujpest Doza. And of course, you know, the job of the Gladys Street, it felt to me in those days, was to chant hateful things at their opposition so that they would be put off and wouldn't play well. You know, and when Tommy Smith turned up, we had plenty of ammunition and loads of things to say about him with respect to a man who seems to have died because he headed a football too often, possibly. But anyway, that's that. So out comes this team from Hungary, and I thought, what's going to happen now? The Everton fans chanted Co-op Farmers. And I remember standing there thinking, is that an insult? And anyway, they're Hungarian. They won't know what you say. I got addicted to the Gladys Street, and I got addicted to the team, and I got addicted to the city. Andy's story is probably a bit different.
A little bit, but, I mean, to be fair, it was one of my earliest memories of Everton was the 66 Cup final. And not so much watching it on the telly, but your reaction when you got home from Wembley, which was completely bizarre, because you ran around the house picking up everything that was blue and waving it around like a madman.
Hurrah!
It was great fun. But then, you know, like yourself, Ro, you know, I was weaned on football at Burnden Park, you know, with Franny Lee and Wyn Davis and, I mean, yeah. Our David, who is our older brother, swears blind that I saw Nat Lofthouse play, but I honestly can't remember it. I must have been about three. But I used to go to Burnden and watch Bolton, and then, as you quite rightly say, when you get to 12, 13, 14, and you're at school, I mean, the school I was at was about 600 pupils, and there was two City fans, and all the rest were Reds. And you just can't. You've got that far without being a Man United fan. It, like you said, it's just unpalatable to think about. And then, of course, you know, there was the 68 Cup final, which went pear-shaped on us. But then the 69-70 side, and that was when I finally convinced my mum and dad to let me go to a game. I think I was 13. And I remember getting, my first game was Chelsea, March 1970. And March the 28th, 1970, I'll never forget it. Rainy day, got off the train at Lime Street, didn't have a clue how to get to Goodison. You'd never told me because you always used to hitchhike. And the first guy I saw with a blue and white scarf, I said, which bus do I get to Goodison, pal? He went, I don't fucking know, I'm a Chelsea fan. Sorry about the swearing, but anyway, we got the bus together, got to Goodison. It was raining, got in, Everton came out, blew Chelsea away. Howard Kendall scored in 14 seconds. Chelsea hadn't kicked the ball. And it was just 53,000 on the ground that day. There was part of the main stand was built. You know, what was left of the old main stand was still there. It was magic. I got absolutely drenched. We won 5-2, fell in love with the place. And
what about you, Paul? Were you, you know, was all your family blue?
Most of my family were blue because my great grandfather played in the first game at Goodison. So
really?
his heritage was there. His son was my grandfather, and he was the biggest influence on me. I mean, he was as rough as a bear's bottom. Okay, I mean, a real rough docker. He was a boilermaker at Camel Laird's, and he never missed a game at Everton from 1928 till the weekend he died in 1975.
Wow.
Totally dead, devoted blue. But he belonged to that group, that age group that they used to work on a Saturday morning, finish at 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
Used to get the ferry over to the pierhead, have a few drinks in town. And it didn't matter whether it was Everton at home or Liverpool at home. They would go to either game.
Oh, right.
As long as they went to a game on the Saturday afternoon. but he was a devoted Evertonian. But there was a big group of them, half Evertonians, half of them Liverpoolians, and that's what they did. And it was he was so devoted to the game that he used to take a bit like you, Andy. But when he got home, he used to write up notes, and he kept ledgers. And he had a big writing desk. And as I say, he was a rough old man. You know, a boiler maker at Camel Leds. You know, he had to be pretty rough in those days. but he had this writing desk in the front room. You know, like the posh room. And he kept these ledgers. It wasn't called a parlor. I think that's a sort of like a Manchester sort of Lancastrian type term. He kept these ledgers, and I've still got them to this day, of beautifully written, handwritten notes of each game that he went to, where he used to record who scored, you know, incidents in the game, what the attendance was, whether it was raining, whether it was sunny, everything else. And he gave me my love of Everton. And he used to take me to, my parents were quite strict and cautious. And my mum was interested in football, but my dad wasn't. And so he used to take me to reserve games. So I went to a lot of reserve games, both at Anfield and at Goodison, before I actually ever went to a first team game. And I think it was my 9th birthday when I went to my first home game.
Who were they playing?
Don't say you can't remember. Oh dear!
No, it was Walsall in the fourth round of the FA Cup.
Oh, wow.
Not the Bernie Wright game.
The Bernie Wright game.
Oh my god! Bernie Wright. See, I'm still having therapy for him.
And we sat on the back row of the Upper Gladys Street, row O. I can't remember what the seat numbers were, but I remember it being row O. And I went with my brother and I, and my granddad. And my brother had no interest in football at all. And my brother just kept on trying to hit me with the program. And my granddad was like telling him off, stop it, bloody hell, you come here to watch football, stop it. Because he was a grumpy old sod. And you know, I mean, we're going all over the place here. One of the things I love to read about on social media and, you know, other forms of football media is when people talk about when they're young, and the thing that always impresses on people is the brilliance of a green pitch. Now,
especially floodlit matches.
Floodlit matches. But that always makes me think about how wonderful the mind is, because normally by October there wasn't much greenery left on pitches. even though Goodison, you know, was a fairly decent pitch. The only pitch I can ever remember from my childhood that almost always had grass on it was Portman Road, Ipswich Town's ground. That was known as being the best pitch in the land. But yeah, everybody always talks about that, you know, walking up the stairs and then getting the view of the pitch. And I think that's...
Yeah, that's right. That's a special moment.
Yeah.
I can recall a couple of pitches that had very little grass. The baseball ground was famous for it.
Oh, my God.
It was the baseball ground, wasn't it, where they Derby County had a penalty.
Yeah.
And they brought the groundsman on with a tape to paint the penalty spot. Yeah. It disappeared in the mud.
The old main road was a shocking pitch as well. Absolute shocking pitch.
But, you know, in that stuff that's come out today from Scotland about the research, I was about... You know, the danger of heading the ball and all the implications of that. My brain went back to what the ball was like.
Yeah.
When I first went to football, and the first match I saw, I did see Nat Loftus play, and he scored with an header. But the ball, especially on a muddy pitch, you cannot stop yourself going, that must be true. And although football's a much, much lighter these days, I don't know, it would be fun to talk to, you know, what does Duncan Ferguson have to contribute to this debate? A man who, you know, couldn't wait to head the ball, was better at it than anybody I can recall off the top of my head.
It's a good point, Arkid. You know, the if you like, the archetypal centre forwards, you know, like you say, Ferguson, Andy Gray, even Sharpie.
Yeah. You know, all of them.
Yeah. Latchford.
Dixie Dean was the great.
Well, Dixie,
is supposed to have been the greatest header of a ball ever.
Yeah.
He scored something like 40% of his goals were scored with his head. And you know, the bits I've read about him, and I'm sure there are people listening to this who know much more about him than I do, was that he was an absolute master at heading. He could obviously head the ball towards the goal with great strength, but also he was very deft with his flick-ons. He was what in modern parlance would be a target man as well as a goal scorer. And to think on those pitches,
yeah,
with the level of training that he had, and then with those balls that they used in those days, what a sight that must have been.
Mm. Absolutely, because those balls must be, you know, back then, it must have weighed at least three times what a modern ball weighs, if not more.
Yeah, and of course, also they had the lace as well.
Mm.
Yeah. You remember if you ever headed the ball on the lace?
That fantastic story of Tom Finney crossing the ball for Stan Mortensen and him heading a goal, an international. And as he goes back, he's rubbing his forehead and Tom Finney says to him, "You're right." He said, "Yeah, it's just that when Stan centres it, he centres it so I don't head the laces." But this is not, you know, not a comic subject. And the first thing you think when I heard, I listened to a quite detailed report on it today, is that somebody has got to consider whether we play football without heading the ball. Because, you know, if you were putting, you know, my grandson's 4, what am I going to say? Or, you know, what's his dad going to say about heading the ball, you know? They are fairly shocking statistics, and I just don't, you know, not smart enough to think through where this is going to go. But it's surely going to produce an enormous amount of caution about that action, which is so fundamental to the game. Unless you suddenly go to a game of football that's like five-a-side, where, you know, the head doesn't come into it at all, does it?
No, it's nothing over waist height, is it?
Yeah.
In general terms.
There's been a lot of talk, hasn't there, in recent years in junior football, and I think it's the case, isn't it, in some forms of junior football. I don't know if it's the case in the UK or not. But I know, for example, in the US, very reluctant to allow young kids to head the ball.
I think they're a bit more cautious in the States, aren't they, because of the amount of injuries that get sustained in American football, where they're all heavily protected.
But
even so, there's been lots of cases of players suffering long term effects of concussion, which prompted the movie Concussion, which I thoroughly recommend everybody to see. But I don't know, could you eradicate heading from the professional game?
You just make a rule that goes, you can't lift the ball above shoulder height.
Wow. You see, that's interesting, because I'd be fundamentally against that. I think it's, I think armed with the knowledge, you make people aware of the risks, and then you allow people to take the risk or not as they see fit.
Like boxing, motor racing, it's dangerous.
The other thing as well, Arkid, about, you know, you say. You know, no lifting the ball above head height. Well, Andy Gray used to head him at toe height.
That's right. You know, I was only thinking of Duncan Ferguson today and how many times he would stoop because he he must have been more confident of what contact he could make with his head than perhaps he was with his feet.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, but it's going to be an interesting debate, and it'll be interesting to hear, you know, for once, what Shearer has to say. You know, he was a pat, you know, I mean, I began to think whether it's all to do with just timing it properly. If you time, you know, if you time a heading the ball correctly, I don't know. I just don't know what I'm talking about.
I mean, look, one of the best headers of the ball in the modern game, or most recently modern game, was Tim Cahill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, relatively small guy. I don't know, 5'9", 5'10" at most. Didn't ever weigh more than 68 kilos. When, you know, during his playing career,
right?
And I think George, for him, it was all about timing. It was all about timing, yeah, in terms absolutely. Of the physicality, so that he could bully people that were probably 10-15 kilograms heavier than him, uh-huh. and certainly, you know, 4 or 5 inches, maybe more sometimes, taller than him. Saw him get beaten to, you know, a headed challenge, did you?
No, that's all absolutely true. Mm. I'm just raising the subject and waiting for somebody to say something wise, because I've got, I don't know. No, I listened to the thing at 1 o'clock today. I thought about it all day, and I don't know what you do. I know that the FA know, it's like, you know, the cigarette industry. The FA knows full well that this report was coming, and it's sitting on its hands going, well, we'll need a bit more information, because it's scary. You know, the only way to really do it is to radically rethink football, which won't be a popular thing at all. And I think maybe you're right. You know, you go, there are risks involved in this. There are risks involved in motor racing. There are risks involved in boxing.
When you think about it, every time those players cross the white line on the to go on the pitch, I mean, you know, they're a missed second, mistiming from a broken leg.
Well, you know, one thinks of Seamus and a double broken leg.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
I suppose the thing with head injuries, though, is that whilst a broken leg is obviously very painful and could shorten your career, that could have implications later in life.
Head injuries don't come to light till a lot later.
It's the long-term accumulative effect of doing something that's obviously currently a key part of the game.
Mm. Well, you know, these statistics and the way they measured it kind of proved, as much as statistics can, that the incidence of dementia, early onset dementia amongst football players, was a good deal greater than amongst, you know.
It is interesting. We've sort of gone a bit down memory lane in bits tonight. A great friend of mine at school played, was a very, very good footballer, and so much so that Everton wanted to sign him. And he refused to sign for Everton because he didn't see himself having a long-term future in football. He was a very good sportsman. He actually played other sports at international level. Very, very good guy. But he refused to have a career in football because he was, and this was in the late 1970s, early 1980s, because of the potential impact of heading a ball. And this kid was just an ordinary kid from Liverpool. He was aware of the risks then, slightly unusually, but he was aware of the risks then, and he refused to have a career in football because of that.
Hmm. Yeah, and we're in the middle of a Rugby World Cup, and some of the contact in that is scary. I was just thinking then that the only time I realised that there was a danger was when somebody centred it properly and I was supposed to head it. And as the ball approached, I sort of thought, no, I'm not doing that.
some of the greatest goals ever scored are headers, aren't they?
Of course, absolutely, yeah. I don't know where we go with that one.
And I know when I played football, not to any great standard, but when I loved nothing better than a header. Something about, you know, perfectly.
Well, yeah.
As much as in amateur football you can perfectly time something, there's something about that feeling when the ball bounces off your forehead. Yeah. It's interesting. It's a very good point, George. It'd be interesting to see where it goes.
It will. It's got to go somewhere.
Yeah. Can we turn back to Everton for the remaining minutes of the podcast?
For sure.
I got myself into a little bit of hot water with a few people over the weekend, commenting on Mr. Kenwright, Bill Kenwright, who, having not been seen at all throughout the period of doom and gloom that has been our season so far, suddenly appeared in front of the cameras. And I just wanted your take on it. I made my take was very clear that, oh dear, what a surprise. I just wondered, if you don't want to talk about it, you don't have to talk about it, because I think it's significant, and I think it's indicative of something that's much more important. It's indicative of a lack of consistency and a lack of leadership. Roger Armstrong said something very interesting yesterday. He said, real leaders turn up when times are tough.
Yeah.
I think the problem for Bill is because of his number one industry, and forgive me for saying this, Arkin, it's the ego massaging and wanting to be in, you know, in the limelight. And he was an actor. He probably finds it difficult to resist. I do think he went probably, I mean, did he have to refer to him as being tiny? He was sizist. And planting the smacker on him, I'm not he gets carried away, doesn't he? I mean, we'd won and we'd played well, and Bill being Bill, he couldn't resist it. But I do tend to agree with Paul's underlying message that, you know, why does it take that for him to come out and do anything publicly when we've been so desperate for the last 4 or 5 weeks and everyone's beaten a hasty retreat?
Well, how many, you know, I mean, to be reasonably fair to Bill, how many chairmen get interviewed anyway? You know, I've never seen an interview with Dan Levy after a match. I don't even know the name of the chairman of Liverpool. I've no idea who the chairman of City is. I've no idea who the chairman of these people are. Bill is, you know, he's a notice box. And if you give him a chance, if you give him a stage, he'll take it because he can do that stuff. And, you know, but for me, and this is, you know, this is probably nearer to where Paul's at. Because I knew I couldn't watch the match on Saturday, the truth of the matter was, I thought to myself, I kind of hope we lose. Not because of Marco Silva, but because of Bill. Because unless the club is to turn around, you know, it can only happen if something bad happens. So to see him ebullient after winning is not a big surprise. And, you know, and I was, you know, of course I was glad we won, but if it's just going to go hopscotching on like this, you know, we've maybe finished 10th now. That's, you know, I'm sick of this now, and I have to believe that it's top down. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of with Paul in thinking that, you know, the changes, Marco Silva being sacked, which I wouldn't have argued about and won't argue about, is almost cosmetic compared to what needs to happen to make the club proud again. I don't believe it's a proud organisation. And I think that comes from the top, frankly. I don't know Mashiri, I don't know any of the other people. Bill's the only person I know, and the reason I know Bill is because I'm in the same profession, but also because Bill is, you know, happy to be available sometimes. And Paul's quite right to go, oh yeah, you're available now. But I presume the media didn't want to talk to him when we got beat by Burnley. And I'm presumably he would have gone, no, I'm not talking to them. And he seemed to have got caught in that situation, didn't he, where he was giving the bloke a hug and then the camera went you know, give us a turn, Bill, and he did. So he does.
He's good at it, doing it.
But, you know, the deeper point is, yes, we're all chuffed to bits that we played well and bonked West Ham, and we'll all be even more chuffed to bits if we do the same to Brighton and whoever's after that, you know, Watford in the Carabao Cup. That'd be great. And if that momentum and all those standards get kept to, and Everton, go on a 20-game, not a run, but this is a redefinition of those. That'd be great. I doubt that will happen. I hope to God it does. Nobody be happier than me to hold my hands up and go, I was wrong, totally wrong. Wrong about Brexit, wrong about Trump.
you're right, George. It can't be whitewashing over the issues that are underlying within the club. And that, that's what Paul was, correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, that's what you were alluding to, is that, one swallow doesn't make a summer. We've still got massive problems. And Bill coming out and being as ebullient as he was, is what you expect of him. But like you say, where's he been for the previous 8 weeks?
Yeah, it's that, but it's also I know a lot of people will not like me for saying this and will say, you're a miserable old sod, blah blah blah. But it's that lack of corporate discipline that really distresses me, and distresses me because if the corporate discipline is so poor, it means that it's poor in other areas as well, and. I just want to see some professionalism, some consistency, some leadership throughout the whole period. And George, you make a very good point. For an awful lot of clubs, the chairman is a totally invisible character. Perhaps he writes something in the annual report, sometimes possibly in program notes, whatever. But that's not the case with Everton. Bill has been synonymous with Everton for many, many, many years.
And happily so. He's proud of it. He's proud of it.
Absolutely. But then, and that's okay because, he's a shareholder and he's been chairman for, an awful long time and everything else, even though my own personal belief is that he shouldn't be chairman. Just wish somebody in the organisation would get hold of him and say, okay, if you're going to do it today, you should have done it 3 weeks ago, or you should have done it 2 weeks ago. So don't do it today. And it's that they're the type of things that I don't know, and it's slightly different from everybody else. They're the type of things that I worry about because nobody is in control of the situation.
The trouble is, Paul, who, other than Moshiri, who's going to say that to Bill?
Well. You're right.
Well, Paul did.
No. I mean, within the club, I mean, in all seriousness, Bill is chairman. Yeah. Moshiri may be the major shareholder and the real power, but he isn't on the board, so he can't exactly. I mean,
Look, this is a bit bonkers. Nobody is going to, call a board meeting on Monday and go, right, Bill, you mustn't do that again.
No.
Well, actually, George, if I was the CEO of the company, I'd have put a call into him today and said, look, I know you're happy and everything else, and the performance was great, but we're trying to get away from doing things like that in this club. We're trying to be a professional, responsible sporting organization, etc., etc. And I would have had that conversation.
Good for you.
I might be looking for a job tomorrow, but I would have had that conversation.
Yeah, well, I totally support that point of view. I have no great history in my life of those kind of levels of decisions. But if that's what you feel, then fair play for saying so. And I'm glad that you've had this little forum to elaborate on it too, because it is a bit Mickey Mouse. I love this lad. All that Elsa Wackatier stuff, you know, I remember, you know, yes, it would be, I guess.
Is it the problem that Bill genuinely is a fan, whereas most other people in his position are not? They're there for a business. Like Levy, you never even see Levy smile. Even when Tottenham were doing well, you never see him smile. Bill genuinely punches the air when Everton score.
He does. No, he's an Evertonian. He's a Blue. What can you say?
I've sat in quite a few directors' boxes around the country.
Yeah,
and I've yet to meet a chairman or CEO who hasn't become a fan of the club that they're working at.
No, and doesn't. I understand that, Paul, but do they take it dare to say, passionate level that Bill obviously has?
Possibly not, and I suppose we shouldn't be too critical of it being that's in Bill's character, as George quite rightly points out. All I'm saying is that even if it's within your character, you can be disciplined, and you should be disciplined. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure Daniel Levy is absolutely chuffed when they, you know, when they score a goal, but he doesn't leap out of his seat and, you know, sort of give it the high fives. Mashiri's looking at his phone. I always love that clip of him looking at his phone and realizes we've scored.
The funniest one I can remember, sorry for butting in,
yeah,
was at Wolves a few years ago. And I was in the director's box at Wolves, and Bill was there with John Woods.
Yeah.
Which when Moisey was manager. And we won 3-0. Beckford scored, Phil Neville scored, and Bill Yelechdinov scored an absolute screamer. And when Beckford put us 1-0 up, we all stood up and applauded. And Phil Neville scored, which was a terrific goal, actually.
Yeah, his was a screamer, wasn't it?
His was a screamer from the corner of the box. And Bill jumped up. But when Bill Yelechdinov scored, the whole Everton contingent went absolutely berserk. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Bill and John Woods and Robert Elster were all hugging one another. It was to Gladys Street in the Wolves director's box. It was hilarious to see. Oh. It genuinely was. But... No, I do take your point, Paul, and don't disagree at all. That maybe a man in his position should be just a little bit more guarded occasionally.
Yeah. I know a lot of people are going to say, I think your view is wrong, and I think it's good to see people who are passionate and committed and everything else. But hey, that's my view. Look, we've run over time. Just over the hour. We're obviously delighted with the performance on Saturday. Puzzled why the performance hasn't, that type of performance and that type of freedom, the ability to express yourself, hasn't been permitted in previous games. But I guess we can only go into the next game at Brighton, which is, since they've been back up in the Premier League, been quite a difficult fixture for us, hoping that it's going to be more of the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Go and play with some freedom and passion and commitment and take him out.
Yeah, and let's hope, injuries permitting, that he plays the same team.
You would think that's the oldest cliche in the game, isn't it? Don't change a winning team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So gents, we will reconvene in a week's time, and hopefully we will be talking about a famous victory at Brighton.
Bill cuddling more than one player.
Oh dear, let's not go there. Gents, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Andy. Thank you to everybody who's listening to us. And please keep the comments and the feedback coming. We learn a lot from it. So thank you very much. See you next week.